Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey guys, just before we get started, I wanted to kind of put a swear warning because I realize I do in fact swear a lot, and I just kind of want to make sure if any kiddies are listening that you should probably stop now unless you're a mature child. And also I'd like to say, sorry mom. Let's get started with the episode.
Long may she reign. Presented to you by Aidan Fitzgerald.
Oh, baby, we are so motherfucking back. Good afternoon. My name is Aidan. Welcome back to the Long May She Reign podcast. Woo! I'm very sorry, guys. This episode is very clearly late. This was supposed to come out on Tuesday. But I moved from my dormitory back home because I'm officially done university. Woo, can you believe that even happened? Like, when I started this podcast, I wasn't even in university yet. I was in my gap year. And now we're here. And I'm done. And I have a degree for somehow. I don't know how I did that. But I do. I do have one, and it's so pretty, and it costs so much money, and I can't wait to be paying that off for the next couple of years. Sorry, my pop is overflowing right now. Ah, don't get on the computer, please, no! Oh my god, stop overflowing. I apologize. No. Are you done? Stop. Oh my god. Okay, I think it's done. I think I did it. I'm sorry. That was an accident. Why it wouldn't stop bubbling. Anyway, what's happened in the last couple of weeks? Well, you know, Taylor Swift released her new album, which is very on theme for the episode we're about to have today. Honestly, some of her finest work, really. I mean, I was crying. I was listening to it as I was packing to come home, and it hurt a lot. I'd love to maybe hear, you know, maybe I'll put this on the episode. I'd love to hear if any of you guys are Swifties, which I know some people who do listen to this are. I'd love to hear what your guys' favorite song is from both the original track Run and the anthology, because I know I have my favorites. Surprisingly, I'd say for the first album, I'd say Who's Afraid of Little Old Me was my favorite, and I didn't expect it to be my favorite. And then for the anthology, oh, it's like a hard tie between, triple tie, between Cassandra, Peter, or The Prophecy, because those are really, really good. Also, in good news, my grades are starting to trickle in slowly. So far, all A's. I've never gotten all A's, not in the entire 4 years I've been to university, so I'm hoping I stay on track to have all A's. I'll kind of be sad if I get a B, even though a B would normally be perfectly acceptable, but whatever. Also, speaking of Taylor Swift, I added more money to her bank. I bought some of the Tortured Poets Department's merch because she just seems to know when I have money and the ability to spend that money. So I bought the cardigan and I bought the necklace, even though I told myself after I got my Speak Now cardigan that I'd probably never order from there again because, like, the process of, you know, getting my Speak Now cardigan was so annoying, but I did it because I have a problem. I'll show you guys when it gets here. It's both are on their way. Anyway, enough about me. We spent way too long with my pop try and overflow. Probably not going to edit that out just because it's funny. Anyway, today we are talking about Clara Bow. Now, some of you guys may have heard of her, you may have not. You may have first been introduced to her by, Taylor Swift coming out with her song that's named after Clara Bow. I did know who Clara Bow was before the song came out, and I was really excited when I heard that there was going to be a song named after her. I was more hoping it was going to be like a biography, like how Last Great American Dynasty was about Rebecca Harkness. It wasn't. It was still a good song. And I thought that a lot of people, after listening to Clara Bow's song, might want to know more about her. And I certainly wanted to dig a little deeper into her life because I just know her by reputation. She was literally the first It Girl. If you've ever heard the term It Girl, it comes from Clara Bow. She invented being an It Girl. She has a fascinating life. It is happy, it is sad. There's a lot of mental health issues in Clara Bow's life that are going to be really interesting to get into. I hope you guys are excited for today's episode. Let's get into it. So, Clara Bow was born on July 29th, 1905, in Prospect Heights, Brooklyn, as the only surviving child of Robert Walter Bow and Sarah Frances Gordon Bow. Now, since she was born on July 29th, that makes her a Leo, and oh my goodness, it's been forever since we've done a Leo on the show. God, when was the last time we did a Leo? Wait, let me check my notes. Elizabeth Bathory. Elizabeth Bathory might have been the last Leo we did that's confirmed. I want to say Catherine Parr was also possibly a Leo, but I could be wrong. I don't remember. Now, as you guys are probably familiar with if you've listened to the show a lot, I'm not like the most hardcore believer in astrology. I feel like my mom's a harder believer in astrology than I am. Like, I definitely like it, but I wouldn't say it's like the end-all be-all determinant of one's personality, certainly not in my case. But in this case, I have never seen a more Leo than Clara motherfucking Bow. Leos are confident and bright and alluring people, though they can be jealous and controlling and possessive at their worst. And if that doesn't describe Clara Bow, I don't fucking know what does. Leos are fire signs, and they are very much the type of people who are like, look at me, look at me, look at me. They want to be noticed, and they are the kind of people that are absolutely born for the spotlight, which puts Clara down to the last detail. But how, I hear you ask, through the void of the internet, how did Clara Bow make it big into 1920s Hollywood? Well, let's meet her parents and learn a bit about her upbringing, education, and what was it about her face and personality that made her one of the most popular actresses in the early American film industry. Now, I think it's only natural that someone as interesting as Clara has an equally interesting birth story, and who's as crazy? Now, Clara's parents already had two kids prior to Clara, but they both died in very early infancy. A doctor had advised Clara's mother, Sarah, to not try and have another baby because there was a possibility that she was going to die this next time. But that advice was soundly ignored, probably for, like, birth control reasons. And Sarah Bow quickly became pregnant with Clara. Now, as if a risky pregnancy wasn't bad enough, the summer that Clara was born was the worst heat wave New York had experienced, like, in a while. And, like, air conditioning wasn't a thing back then. Well, actually, it was it? It might have been a thing for rich people, certainly not for Clara. Her family could not have afforded it. They could barely afford the apartment that she was born in. So, either way, even with this risky pregnancy, the fact that this heat wave was going on was possibly going to kill her mother. And according to Clara, she said this later, her mom was so sure that the heat would kill them both, that she didn't even bother with a birth certificate for Clara. But thank God it didn't kill Clara, as she was born in the very rat-infested tenements of early 1900s New York or Brooklyn. Now, to say Clara had a rough upbringing would be an understatement, and it was mostly a result of her parents. Her father, Robert, was a first-generation American whose parents had immigrated to New York before he was born, and the kind of poverty that Robert grew up in ended up making him a serial alcoholic who was more out of work than working. I also found various accounts from Clara talking about her father. Now, her descriptions of him kind of range all over the place from good to bad. For the most part, she describes him as a sad alcoholic who had the potential to be something but never quite lived up to that potential, and a man who was desperately in love with her mother. But her mother would never be able to properly reciprocate those feelings. So speaking of which, Clara's mother was also a first-generation American and the daughter of Scots-Irish immigrants. She also grew up in a decent amount of poverty, much like Robert. Now, when Sarah was about 16, she accidentally fell out of a second-story window in the apartment that she was living in. And despite the fact that she didn't die from falling out of a second-story window, which sounds like it would hurt, she suffered a really bad head injury from that really gnarly fall, and it gave her severe epilepsy, psychosis, and just a range of other mental health issues that Clara had to contend with as a child. Now, Clara would say of her mother's health issues, her mother could be mean, and she often was, but she didn't mean to be, and that it was because she couldn't help it. And fuck, that makes me so sad. Like, Clara was a little girl, and since her parents taking care of her, she was taking care of her parents while they struggled through, you know, addiction and mental health issues. Like, it wasn't Sarah's fault that she acted the way she did, but it's certainly, like, not great. Like, no kid should have to deal with an alcoholic for a dad and, like, a psychotic mother growing up. But unfortunately, that was Clara's life. And her parents' issues were just one factor of her pretty horrible childhood. Poverty was another. Now, Clara moved around a lot in her childhood, and they almost always stayed within Prospect Heights. And even though she was poor, she still went to public school like most kids her age, because truancy laws became a thing around the time Clara was born. But it was pretty hard for her to fit in at any public school she attended. Now, Clara found that she didn't really fit in with any of the girls at the school she attended because of her, you know, dirty clothes and, in her words, carrot top hair. Clara quickly found more in common with many of the boys at her school, and she became the resident tomboy in her little school gang. She made many close male friends. Now, when Clara was 10, one of her guy friends lived in the building next to her, and unfortunately it caught fire, which, you know, tended to happen in those dirty tenements. Clara ran in to try and rescue him by wrapping him in a carpet to put out the fire on him, but unfortunately the kid didn't make it and died in Clara's arms. Clara would recall later how the death of one of her best friends haunted her for the rest of her life, and I can't imagine the kind of effect that has on a little girl to see someone she was so clearly close with die so young simply because the shitty building that they all lived in could not only burst into flames really easily, but also the lack of help they would have gotten from the local fire department, which was pretty much nothing. Even if you could get a hold of the fire department, there was no guarantee that they would come fast, let alone at all. I believe the fire departments back then used to be ran by gangs, so not a lot of help there. Now, as for Clara's education, she got a pretty standard education that you could get at a New York public school with subjects like math, English, and science. She got pretty good grades in general, but Clara's greatest love was gym class. Now, this is going to make Clara sound like a bit of a pick-me, or, you know, not like other girls, but she was pretty much the only girl in her school to do any sports. Clara was a very, very fast runner, and as a young teenager, she was sure she was going to grow up and become an athletics instructor. She would go on to win 5 medals in local running competitions. It's pretty impressive considering she didn't have any actual professional training in running. The most she got was that she trained with her cousin, Homer Baker, who was himself a professional track runner. So maybe that's all the professional help she needed. I don't know if it like really counts if your trainer is your cousin. I mean, he was a professional. He did win. I believe he went to the Olympics. I can't remember. I didn't write that down, but she got trained by her cousin. He was really supportive of her possible athletic career. Now, as for her appearance, my God, was Clara Bow not just the prettiest person you've ever seen in your life? Like, The second I looked at her, I was like, oh my god, she looks like Betty Boop. And she really does. She has these, like, big, dark, expressive eyes. She was a redhead. I assume a natural redhead coming from her mom's side with the, you know, Scots Irish genes. She had this nice slender figure, perfect for the era that she was about to define. You know, she would have her eyebrows drawn in these, like, thin way, very 1920s, gorgeous. Now, I have no idea how tall she was, but she does give me, like, short vibes. Like, I don't know if that's just the way she looks in pictures, but she looks short to me. So that's the assumption I'm going to make. She is this, just this, like, cute little pixie tomboy before it was cool, and I just love that about her. And you know what? So did America. Speaking of which, let's get into how exactly this spunky little redhead from Brooklyn got her start in the film world. Now, as Clara aged, her home life only seemed to get worse as her dad continued to be a raging alcoholic, and it's a decent possibility that he, and trigger warning for this, I'm going to give you guys a second. Okay, right, is everyone gone? All right. There's a decent possibility that Clara's father sexually assaulted her at some point when she was a teenager. Now, this is like hearsay. I couldn't find that everyone agrees with this accusation, but there are some people who say that he might have done that. I don't know. Okay, trigger warning over. Not to mention, Clara's mom's mental condition only seemed to get worse as the years went by. Now, despite all this hardship, Clara had one escape, and that was to go to the movies. Now, by the time Clara was a teenager, the movie industry was popping the fuck off in America, and over 50 million Americans attended the movies every week. And Clara was one of those people. Now, it's hard to understand now in an era of literally unlimited media, but for Clara, as a poor kid with not much to do in 1920s Brooklyn, the movies provided an escape from her home life where she could see new landscapes, stories, and people. Besides, going to the movies was like a nickel back then, so it was no big deal. Now, Clara knew immediately that she belonged in the movie industry, but her mom was not so keen on that. Now, despite the fact that movies were popular in America and in many other places in the world, lots of people didn't really see being an actress as a very respectable profession, and Clara's mother was, well, one of those people. In fact, Clara's mom was so set against her daughter becoming an actress that one night in February of 1922, Clara was sleeping, and she woke up in the middle of the night to find her mother holding a butcher knife to her throat. And basically, her mom was like, if you become an actress, I'm gonna kill you! Luckily, Clara was able to fight her mother off and lock her in a bedroom, and in the morning when she calmed down, her mom didn't remember doing that to her at all. Like, not at all. And at this point, it seemed that Clara's father had no more patience for his wife and decided to commit her to a sanitarium, which I get in some ways. Like, I get why he might have had to do that. Because, like, even if she doesn't mean the stuff she's doing, she's still dangerous. She could have cut Clara's throat and then, like, not remembered it and, like, had a mental breakdown about killing her daughter. But also, at the same time, like, a 1920 sanitarium is about the last place I'd want to go as a fellow mentally ill person. Unfortunately for Sarah, she would die in that sanitarium only a few years after she was placed there. And it's really sad to see that she was treated like that. Like I said, I get it. She was a danger to her own family and probably to herself. I get why she had to go there, but like it still sucks. I wish that wasn't her fate. And I wish Clara hadn't had such a bad relationship with her mother. Now, in 1921, just before the butcher knife incident, Clara, with her father's support, entered the 1921 Fame and Fortune Contest. Now, in the past, the contest had given its winners a shot at gaining film roles, so Clara decided to enter, and at just 16 years old, she won. Now, in January, issues of the 1922 Motion Picture Classic Contest jury, Howard Chandler, Christy Nessa, and Harrison Fisher said of Clara, "She is very young, only 16, but she is full of confidence, determination, and ambition. She is endowed with a mentality far beyond her years. She is a genuine spark of divine fire. The 5 different screen tests she had showed this very plainly, her emotional range of expression provoking a fine enthusiasm from every contest judge who saw the tests. She screams perfectly. Her personal appearance is almost enough to carry her to success without the aid of the brains she undoubtedly possesses. That's a really nice blurb about her, don't you think? It's cute. Now, the publisher of the magazine that printed that said he was determined to get her a job in the movie business as fast as he could. And soon enough, she was introduced to the director of a film called Beyond the Rainbow, and she was cast in the movie after she impressed the director with her ability to cry on command. Now, I forgot to write this down, but Claire was famous for her ability to be able to cry on command, and I love that because I can also do that. I don't know why I can do that, but I can. But my favorite comment that she ever made about her ability to cry on command is she said that she could do it because all she had to do was think about her childhood. Which is so funny and is totally a joke. Anyway, now Beyond the Rainbow was being filmed on Long Island, so it was a really easy commute for Claire to get set. And after a few months of filming, she finished her part, and she was so excited about the work she did on that movie that she invited all her friends to the premiere, and she was cut from the film. Yikes. Now, at that point, I'm sure Claire must have been thinking that her mom must have been right in not wanting her to be an actress, but her dad pushed her to keep trying, so she went out to look for more work, and she found it pretty difficult to do so, because there was always something directors didn't like about her. She was either always too young, too little, too fat, and apparently she got called fat a lot, which is crazy, considering how skinny she was. But that's society for you. It hasn't much changed, has it? Now, eventually, she was able to catch the attention of director Elmer Clifton, who needed a tomboy for his movie Down to the Sea and Ships. Now, after some serious back-and-forth negotiation, Clara was cast in a supporting role for $50 a week, which is like $1,000 a week in today's money. Now, the movie was shot in Bedford, Massachusetts for a few months, where Clara actually had to call upon her years of fighting with boys so she could do a fight scene. Like, no stunt double for Clara. She did her own stunts. Now, the film came out in September of 1922, and despite the fact that Clara was only, like, the 10th highest billed actress in the movie, the reviews could not shut the fuck up about her performance. Everyone loved her. Now, by 1923, she was getting so much work that I'm just going to take you through the cliff notes. of a lot of the movies she did, because it's a lot and we could be here forever. Now, 3 months after Down to the Sea in Ships was released, Clara danced on a table uncredited in a movie called Enemies of Women, 1923. Now, during that same year, she made a short film called The Pill Pounder. And in spring of 23, Clara got a part in The Daring Years, where she befriended actress Mary Carr, who taught her how to use makeup in a more professional setting. In the summer, she got another tomboy part in a movie called Grit, a story that dealt with juvenile crime. It was written by F. Scott Fitzgerald, which is iconic. I don't know if you guys know this about me. I have beef with F. Scott Fitzgerald. We may be possibly related based on our last names, but you guys will find out about beef one day when I do an episode on his wife, Zelda, because Francis, I've got beef with you, all right? I've got beef with how you treated your wife. Anyway. Now, during these early years, Clara met one of her first of many boyfriends, Arthur Jacobson, who would end up becoming a famous cameraman because of her. Now, in 1924, Clara was approached by Jack Backman of the independent Hollywood studio Preferred Pictures, who wanted to sign her to a studio contract in Hollywood, which was a very new thing at the time. Now, at first, Clara was not too keen to move west and wanted to stay on the East Coast and do movies, but once again, her father encouraged her to do it, saying it couldn't do her any harm, so she decided to go. Now, almost the second Clara moved to Hollywood, she was a hot commodity, with four films coming out every single year, and the public just fucking adored her. They loved her so much. Now, unfortunately, there's a bad side to this, because there always is. I mean, have you listened to this show before? If you haven't, welcome. Unfortunately, like many people in the early Hollywood system, and some people, honestly, today, she was heavily exploited by her agent, who took a lot of her money and overworked the shit out of her. I mean, four movies a year, that's a lot. Now, while she lived out in Hollywood by herself at first, she was eventually... she would eventually defy her agent and bring her dad out to live with her and her boyfriend Arthur, who had also started working for the studio that had hired Clara. Now, over time, it seemed that Clara and Arthur's relationship became more of a brother-sister arrangement. But despite the fact that they were no longer dating, they remained good friends and supported each other in, you know, their respective careers. They even lived together for a decent amount of time, even though they weren't dating, which I think is, it's cute that they were able to stay friends and really supported each other's career. Arthur seemed like he was a really good dude. Now, between 1924 and 1926, Clara was in over 30 productions, some of which she did for the studio that owned her contract and others for studios that she was loaned out to, which, again, sounds exhausting just thinking about it. But it wasn't all bad, though, because in 1925, she began dating her co-star, Gilbert Roland, who was a Mexican-American guy and would become her first fiancé. Now, speaking of fiancés, dating, morality, stuff like that. Back in the day, a lot of starlets, really just women in a lot of cases, but men too, a lot of actors had to sign morality clauses in contracts so that they couldn't do, you know, like bad things in the public eye. They couldn't like go around dating a lot and stuff like that. Like, it's important that they like, you know, be married and stuff like that. But Clara was built different. And she was dating and getting engaged on and off for years at a time. And Preferred Pictures fucking hated her for that. They were like, honey, you gotta stop doing this. And Clara was like, sorry, I'm on my third engagement. Now, Clara had open liaisons with various male stars and directors, including, but not limited to, Gary Cooper, Victor Fleming, who was the director of The Wizard of Oz in the 1930s. So she regularly appeared in a bad light in, like, early gossip magazines, but some people actually admired her for it. Now, having watched a few of the movies that I can find of hers, and it's not easy, by the way, I completely understand why the movie-going public loved her so much. I always find old-timey movies to be, like, really hard to watch because the acting can be weird and stuff, and, like, you know, the movies back then just aren't made for audiences today. But Clara just seems so natural and alive compared to other silent film stars, and I think that's why people loved her. She had no professional training. She just went out and did it, and she was good at it. So, honestly, I think she just had this, like, I don't give a fuck attitude about life, and I love her for it. Like, really, she did not give two shits at all. Anyway, in 1927, Clara starred in the film that she is best remembered for, and that was a movie called It. Not the one with clowns. Now, in the movie It, Clara played a shop girl who was in love with her wealthy boss. Now, the film got rave reviews and increased her already rocketing stardom. And it's from this film that we get the term It Girl, because when people would meet her, they'd be like, oh, hey, aren't you that It Girl? The girl from It? And of course, the term is much different today. But the next time you call someone an It Girl, don't you goddamn forget who invented the term. You think on that for a second. Anyway, by the late 1920s, films were transitioning into the sound era, which many actors struggled to deal with, especially Clara. Even though she was having difficulty translating into talkies, which is what they called them, she was still pretty much thriving in that industry. Like, even though she was, like, made really uncomfortable by sound films, because, like, she would get spooked by the microphones that they used to capture sound. Like, they had to do a lot of takes because she kept on looking up at it. The people still loved her, but she just wasn't adapting properly to sound films. And because of that, Clara's career would not last much longer after the 1920s. But it wasn't just the fact that she couldn't really transition over to talkies. It was also because of the abuse she faced by the people managing her career that pretty much sent her into a complete and total mental breakdown. Now, sometime in the late 20s, she checked herself into a sanitarium, and when she came out, she chose to retire because of the increasing pressure of her career and the stress of the spotlight. Now, despite only working for 11 years, Clara was a prolific actress and made over 53 films, which is mad impressive for only a decade-long career. Like, what? I'm trying to think about, like, people who have made, like, as many movies as that, but, like, in a longer time period. Like, isn't, like, Samuel Jackson, like, the person with, like, the most films, like, ever made? Doesn't he have, like, 80 or 90 films? And, like, he's been around for decades. So the fact that, like, Clara's, like, only, like, not that much behind him, and she only worked for, like, 11 years. It's crazy. There was, however, a bright spot about her retirement and her unfortunate mental breakdown. There's nothing good about mental breakdowns. I know, I have them a lot. Anyway, she finally managed to make it down the aisle after this mental breakdown. When she married fellow actor Rex Bell in December of 1931 in Las Vegas. Now, as I mentioned before, Clara dated a lot of people and was engaged a handful of times, and normally I'd get deeper into that. However, we'd be here all day if I did a deep dive into everyone she ever dated or was engaged to, so let's just focus on the guy she actually ended up marrying, because he's pretty awesome. I like Rex Bell. Now, Rex Bell was born as George Francis Beldam in Chicago on October 16th, 1903. So not only is he only 2 years older than Clara, which is a great age gap, but he's also a Libra, which makes me like him more. Now, him being Libra also means he's a very good match for Clara, according to their compatibility score, which I love. I mean, she's a fire sign, he's an air sign. What a good pairing. Anyway, when he was a kid, his parents moved to California, and Rex became absolutely swept up by the movie industry. In 1928, he made his film debut in The Cowboy Kid. Much like Clara, Rex had no formal acting training, but he had a warm smile, good looks, and wavy hair that made him attractive and got him a ton of parts, mostly in westerns. And honestly, really, it's all you need. A nice smile, wavy hair, you can have anything you want. I mean, I would, if that was me. Now, it was during one of the last films Clara ever did called True to the Navy that she met Rex and fell head over heels for him. And I mean, I would too. He was a hottie. Like, when you're done here, Google a couple of pictures of him. He was pretty cute for, like, the 30s and the 20s. Like, nice. Now, after getting basically eloped in Vegas, before it was cool, by the way, Vegas wasn't, like, you know, the place where you went and got eloped back then. Actually, I don't know where the place was, but it certainly wasn't Vegas, because, you know, Vegas is going to be Atomic City in a couple of years. Well, not a couple of years. It's going to be eventually, okay? After getting eloped to Vegas, they set up their home on a ranch in the town of Searchlight, Nevada, while Rex still worked in Hollywood. While Rex was, you know, focusing on his burgeoning cowboy career, Clara focused on what she wanted to do now that she was retired at the ripe old age of 26. Now, one of the first things she did was become a mother. In 1934 and 1938, Clara gave birth to her two sons, Rex Anthony Beldam Jr. and George Beldam Jr. And I'm gonna have to post this on Twitter or something, but oh my god, they're the cutest photos of Clara and Rex and their kids on the internet that y'all just, like, need to see. Like, Clara and Rex made some cute fucking kids. Like, their sons were adorable. They're so cute. Oh, just want to pinch her little cheeks. Anyway, unfortunately, very early into her retirement, Clara started exhibiting some of the, dare I say, wacky behavior that had landed her mom in a sanatorium. Now, in 1944, while Rex was dipping his toe into politics, Clara unfortunately tried to unalive herself. Now, Rex seemingly tried to balance taking care of Clara and raising their sons, but that's a lot for one person to, again, like I said at the start of this episode, deal with a mentally ill person in your family and then raise a child at the same time. That's a lot, and I really do sympathize with Rex, but of course I mostly sympathize with Clara because it's happening to her. Now, eventually, Clara was admitted to a psychiatric facility in Connecticut to treat her schizophrenia in 1949. And now, I know a lot of people would probably think Rex was a bad person for checking Clara into a psychiatric hospital, because, as we've already discussed, mental health care wasn't the best back then. I mean, the best you could hope for was, like, a lobotomy, and lobotomies suck. But I don't think that Rex was equipped to help her, and even though he loved her, I think he knew she needed to get help somewhere else and protect their kids, because her kids shouldn't have to go through, you know, seeing Clara be off her rocker 24/7. And I don't think Clara would have wanted that for her sons either. Now, when Clara was eventually released from the sanitarium in Connecticut, she chose not to return to her family and lived in a bungalow in Los Angeles. Now, when her husband died in 1962, while he was in the middle of being lieutenant governor of Nevada, technically, she was, like, the first lady of Nevada. She wasn't there when that happened. She went to his funeral, which was one of the first times that she had been seen in a while, like 15 years, and everyone went crazy when she showed up at her husband's funeral. Now, Claire herself would die of a heart attack on September 27th, 1965, at the age of 60, and was buried with her husband in a mausoleum in California. Now, before we get into legacy, let's talk about what happened to Claire and Rex's kids, Tony and George. Now, I was not able to find any info on George or what happened to him, but her oldest son, Tony, had a lot more available information on his life. So I'm sorry, George. I'm sure that there might be something out there about her son that I just don't know about, but I wasn't able to find any information on her son, George, unfortunately. So let's talk about Tony. Now, Tony was raised on his parents' ranch and later obtained a law degree from Willamette University in Salem, Oregon, after serving as a deputy district attorney in Pendleton, Oregon. Tony joined the district attorney's offices in Las Vegas under George Franklin and then Roy Wolfter, and was legal advisor to the Clark County Sheriff and Las Vegas Police Department, which merged in 1973. 6 years later, the newly elected Clark County District Attorney Bob Miller hired Tony as his assistant district attorney, which is a pretty big deal. That's a good job, Tony. Tony retired from public service in 1994 and was married to a woman named Dorothy, with whom he had two sons and a daughter and three stepchildren, and has three grandchildren. Now, Tony died July 8th, 2011, and I hope he was able to meet his parents, especially his mom, up in heaven. I really wish Claire had been able to be a better mother to her sons, and I really hope that both Tony and George understood why she couldn't, because, it must have been a tough thing for her kids, for them to be born and then for her to, basically disappear from their lives when they're not even 10 years old. I really hope he understood that, but it's also okay if he didn't, because, I get it. And not to mention, Claire loved her sons so much. The way she talked about them all the time in a couple of interviews that I read, I just wish her mental health hadn't been so bad that she could have been a good mom. Anyway, I'm sorry. Debbie Downer. This whole episode is going to be a Debbie Downer, I think, as you guys can tell. Getting into legacy, what is there even to really say about Claire Bow's legacy? She literally invented the term it girl. She was a wonderfully bright and talented actress who took Hollywood by storm, and I think the movie industry was better for it. Now, as film historian Leonard Maltin said in 1999, I'm going to be very pretentious about this. You think of Greta Garbo, Lillian Gish, all these great names and great actresses, but Claire Bow was more popular in terms of box office dollars, in terms of consistently bringing audiences into the theaters. She was right on top. And Leonard, I don't know yet, but I could not agree with you more, man. I only wish that her mental health hadn't been so bad and that she hadn't been so overly exploited by people who were supposed to be helping her succeed in the film industry. Like, her screwy-ass agent, motherfucker. Anyway. I wrote this section. I wrote this section before the Tortured Poets department came out. Because I thought I'd be recording this before the album came out. Really, the next thing I'm supposed to say is that I'm really excited for the Tortured Poets Department, but it's already out. And as I said at the start of the episode, I'm going to see if I can do a question thing on this episode, so you guys can tell me what your favorite song from the Tortured Poets Department is. And if you don't have one and haven't listened to it, give it a listen. I really recommend it. Thank you guys so much for joining me. I will see you in 2 weeks with another episode. I really hope you guys enjoyed, and goodbye. Hey guys, thanks for listening. If you have any suggestions for topics, you can just DM me on Twitter at LongMationRain2. The N at the end of rain is replaced with a 2 instead. I'm also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Anchor, and a whole bunch of other stuff. Don't forget to rate and review this podcast on all those platforms. It really actually does help the show so much, and it will help me grow my audience. So I would absolutely appreciate it if you guys could do that. All right, bye.